now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we react to the least meaningful, but probably the most eventful game of the weekend, as Liverpool leave it very, very late to beat Spurs at Anfield. We'll talk about the issues regarding Jurgen Klopp and the referee Paul Tierney as well. Bournemouth look like they've guaranteed their Premier League survival by thrashing Leeds at the Vitality. Are Leeds United sleepwalking into relegation to the Championship? Heartbreak for Nottingham Forest as they're stunned by Brentford, but could Steve Cooper have done better to manage the game? Are Southampton completely gone after their defeat at Newcastle United? We'll talk about Roy Hodgson's resurgence at Crystal Palace as they edge a 7-goal thriller with West Ham. And Erling Haaland reaches 50 goals, but there's one teammate we need to talk about at Manchester City as well. This is The Game. Hello again. Welcome back to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wizencroft alongside Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Tony Cascarino. And we start with the least meaningful match of the weekend, which was probably the most entertaining match of the weekend. There are, I think, some more important fixtures to talk about. But, you know, I think for Liverpool, it was an important 3 points. And for Spurs, well, I guess we can see their season kind of coming to a close in terms of that Champions League race especially. But, look, it was a dramatic finish. Diogo Jota's injury time winner giving Liverpool victory at Anfield after Tottenham looked on course to salvage a point despite being 3-0 down inside 15 minutes. The result leaves Liverpool fifth, 7 points off fourth, having played a game more. So still unlikely for a top four place for them, but Jurgen Klopp's side keep on fighting. But we're going to start, I think, from the Spurs angle, because it was a horrific start once again. I mean, despite the end of the game, and we'll get to it, being, what, 5 goals down after 21 minutes, was it, against Newcastle United, 2-0 down at halftime at home against Manchester United in midweek, 3-0 down after 15 minutes this time around. Basically, Spurs just can't defend, right? So we'll come to Liverpool and what their defence was like, but ultimately, this is what is costing Tottenham Hotspur points, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of things costing Tottenham Hotspur points. But I think kids across the land for their GCSEs and so on should be asked why this keeps on happening to Spurs. Because, you know, history is about learning from your mistakes, and Spurs just keep on repeating them and repeating them. And they know perfectly well they're quite good at responding to adversity this season. They've grabbed points late in games, but they seem to only be able to find an urgency, an ability to string passes together and a semblance of a shape after they've been humiliated. So it's just fascinating what must go on behind the scenes there with the coaching staff, which I know keeps changing on a regular basis. But they can see it. They it's almost like it's not fair. Their puzzle's really easy to solve because it's blatant. What we have is a problem, and that we start shakily, but we have enough quality to try and pull something out of the hat at the end. So how can we eradicate those first 20 minutes, half hour, first half problems? And the fact they're not able to do that is almost spooky. It's really strange. It's as though the process of setting a team up and preparing them for a match is beyond anyone who's in charge. And I think whoever was commentating, it might have been Gary Neville, suggested, but I think a lot of people did suggest, you know, the onus is actually on the players for starting so badly. I can't believe players do it on purpose. It's got to be a fear from the coaching staff that is transmitted to the pitch so that they don't do what they should do wholeheartedly enough. So there was no shape from Spurs for that first half. But almost more importantly, no desire to play football. It's as though they're believing their own myth and that they can't play football when they start a match. But no, I can't, even really, really bad teams, the ones in the bottom three, aren't as bad as Spurs at the start of a game.
Gregor, do you agree? You have to, don't you?
Well, to a point, I do think it's on the players. I think part of it is about belief. I think that it's been such a discombobulating season, if that's the right word for it. Like, they've been battered from pillar to post by managers, by the crowd, by everyone. I think that's part of it. But I think it looks like a lack of belief in what they're being asked to do. And, you know, part of that is perhaps too, like, they've been such a negative team for a long while as well. And then it looks like Ryan Mason's trying to slightly say, no, come on, let's go and take the game to the opposition. But they're not really, they don't really know, they know how they're doing it. You know, they kind of pressed and then they left big gaps, yeah, particularly in midfield. And then that just leaves the back three, you know, kind of wildly exposed. And particularly against Liverpool, because often if they're following players into midfield or they're, you know, they get dragged. They have to maintain a shape, and they didn't do that at all, particularly in the first 15-20 minutes. So it's been a really peculiar season for Spurs. I think it's hard to actually, you know, find any logic in it. I think.
Yeah, but Gregor, yeah, I accept everything you say about lack of belief, and it's been a really, really difficult season for them. But it's been a much more, but they've been on the cusp of Champions League football, and they've been in the Champions League. They have status that should boost their confidence. You look at a team like Nottingham Forest, who've got this awful, you know, away record, and yet on Saturday they were able to set up properly for the most of that match. They started well, i.e. they have every excuse to have a lack of belief in how to defend away from home, and yet all you have to do is say, right, just don't just keep your shape, all of you defend together. If we get a counter-attack, great, but let's just concentrate. Let's just keep strong at the back and concentrate. If Nottingham Forest can do it to start a game when their belief must be shot, why are we being more, oh, bless them, about a team that ought to have much more arrogance because of their pay and the fact that they're on the cusp, still on the cusp, I think. I mean, Hugh says it's a meaningless game. There's still possibility of Champions League football.
Just not the way they're playing.
They also have wildly erratic individuals in that too. You know, you can't look at it all as a collective. They have Christian Romero, they have Porro, who's like, just doesn't look like he knows how to defend, like, be that in terms of your positional sense or in like 1v1 duels. So you have to throw that into the mix too. If you've got, yeah, people who just go wildly off script, which Spurs have had for quite some time, all season definitely, then you're in trouble.
I do think one of the issues for Spurs is just a lack of cohesion, because ultimately half the team are doing one form of defending as a team, if you like, which is they've dropped off, and then the front three or four have pressed on. That's left that massive that massive gaping hole in the middle of midfield.
So do you think they're not being told what to do? I mean,
it wouldn't surprise you. They've got another guy in charge, Ryan Mason, who
he's not an
shouldn't
idiot,
be there.
He should be able to say that, shouldn't he?
All it is, though, is I think it's just an indicator of where the quality is in the team. So the forward players are happy to go and press on. They think they're good enough to go and create pressure. And they are the players that have excelled when Tottenham have been scoring goals. The others are fearful. The midfielders are fearful. The defenders are fearful. And their immediate reaction is to, for their own safety, drop off. That for me is the difference. Harry Kane's happy to go and press. Son's happy to go and put pressure on Richarlison. But, you know, the likes of Romero, Skip, etc., they don't want to be exposed. So it's just I think it's a confidence thing that the forward players seem to have at the moment, and the defenders definitely don't. You see Kane and Richarlison looking around, you know, and Son almost with a smile on their face, like, what are we meant to do? Because these lot back there are just so terrible.
Well, they've scored 63 goals in the Premier League. Now, that's still not the highest number, but it's still quite a lot. I would disagree with Gregor on the player's side, because I've always felt, Gregor, that the best managers I ever played for gave me instructions on my job. Now, and universal in a team, they go around everybody. I feel like, I look at Spurs and I think, how can you go behind so early in a game and make errors that just common sense you could negate. You know, I just don't understand. Look, I said at the start of the season on Spurs, their back line will not make Champions League football because I think the desire to put Eric Dier into a team and then getting the England squad and how he was playing the start of the season, totally, it was just, I just thought, that's a lie, it's a myth. He's not played that well, even early on in the season. And I totally agree with Porro. I think I laughed because I know we're going to talk later about Brentford, and you was at Brentford, Alison, and Serge Aurier is playing right back, and you're thinking they've gone from him to getting Judd Spence in, and then you go, Emerson's not good enough, and then you get Porro, who's as bad as any of them defensively.
See, £39 million. Yeah. In the summer he'll cost.
I just don't get how they're... Well, there's lots of things wrong with Spurs, but there is also a side, and I thought Gary Neville made a really valid point again, and it's something I've spoke about in the way that football's evolved over the recent years and the laws of the game. You have to be attack-minded and a pressing team to be successful. If you look at all the teams at the top, that's all what they're attempting. No one's being pragmatic, conservative and getting much success. Look at Napoli win the league like they're going to do in Serie A. And it's a common theme. And I think watching Spurs sit off a team knowing that Liverpool is what they do at their best, being allowed to literally get their numbers forward and get in attack forward positions, that'll cause you problems. So it was no surprise to me that we'd have said before the game, will this be an high scoring game? Well, I don't think any of us would have gone for a 0-0.
Yeah.
The reason I come back to belief is that look at the goals they've conceded in recent weeks. It's all passive defending. There's been so many times where teams have been allowed to, like, players have been allowed to stroll through the box or crosses have gone into the box. There's no one around them. It's like, I think it's players feeling like they're looking out for themselves, looking out for number one. They don't want to be exposed. They don't want to be the fall guy Davinson Sanchez is. So that's what I mean when I say belief. There's like, there's a fear of like, of making a howler, being the guy who's going to be called out next because it's been that kind of season for them.
Lifeboat scenario, isn't it, Gregor?
Yeah.
I went to the game at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Manchester United giving up a 2-goal lead on Thursday night. A bit like the game at Anfield as well. You know, I absolutely tore Spurs to shreds at half time. And yet, at full time, I said they could have easily won this game as well. Tottenham showed so much fight in the second half on Thursday night. They showed so much fight in the second half at Anfield. Got the equaliser, obviously. Conceded a late goal. I won't say the word that all Spurs fans are looking out for, but what is it about them that suddenly means that after they're a couple of goals down, this isn't just a late thing, this has been throughout the season, they only really start playing, only really start running around, stop being passive when the game's almost gone from them, if not completely gone from them?
It follows my theory that Alisson disagreed with earlier in the season, that there's no easier scoreline than to be 2-0 down. Because the shackles come off. There's no pressure. Yeah. That's why. It's not. You don't deserve credit. Keep reaching for that Roy Keane quote. You know, it's easy to play when you're 2-0 down. It's harder to play when you're like holding on to a leader where it's nip and tuck. Mm. When you're 2-0 down, there's nothing to lose.
Isn't it the influence of Mourinho and Conte, though, who were very negative and didn't want Spurs to be flamboyant? They wanted to instill a sense of, let's be cautious and ease your way into a game. So they're doing something that's against their nature because it was shouted at them by Conte and Mourinho. So because I think the word of the season is actually passive. I don't think anyone used it a year ago. And now everyone who's failing is passive. It's because they're passive. You're absolutely right. It's the word. But they're passive because they were told to be contained. They don't know how to do that. They're not built for that. Because, as we've all discussed, they have great forward players, so exploit them. So, and then it's only when you've got nothing to lose that you remember who you truly are and start attacking.
So, OK, let's get this right, OK? So a manager or a coach on the sidelines, he's losing 2-0. Now he decides to get brave. He decides to make changes to make their team get back into a game, OK? So he only gets brave when you're losing 2-0.
Yeah.
So as much as we can say on the players, but you see the substitutions that come on and how many and how much it makes a difference in a match. Well, maybe if you just started with that intent, you might have not been 2-0 down.
Yeah, they deserve no credit whatsoever.
Not even a little bit. They hit the woodwork three times. Look, you could have scored six goals at Anfield on another day. I mean, you don't get any credit for that.
I'm just saying they don't get any credit for a response at 3-0 down.
Okay. As I mentioned, Spurs could have scored a lot of goals in this match. So we've analysed their defending. What's going on with Liverpool's? And I've got to say, it's four straight wins in the Premier League for Liverpool. The question still has to be there as to whether they could force their way into the most unlikely of top four qualifications. What do we think? Two Liverpool fans in the room.
No chance. And I've said to you, no chance for how long?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, no chance whatsoever are Liverpool going to make the top four. Even if they were 3 points, 4 points behind, they ain't going to make it. I thought we saw yesterday two ridiculously bad teams defending. I mean, Liverpool didn't come out of any glory in this game. Yet we know, it's like I said earlier, you know, this was never going to be 1-0 to either side. It was going to be a goal fest, and who was going to make the most mistakes. And the right back areas in both teams, you know, hearing people wax lyrical about Trent, well, yeah, we all can. If, you know, if he's going to get the ball and be adventurous, he can cause absolute havoc. But also, the team gets affected by his position. I think Liverpool need to think of, yeah, well, if we're going to play Trent there, let's go and buy a new right back. Someone who can actually defend and fill a hole and not put Konate getting stretched out there all the time. Because they were wide open, Liverpool as well. So it was like two teams who play in a similar vein as in how they concede goals. And I've watched Liverpool concede a lot of goals this year in many different competitions. And they have, by the way, there's been a lot of teams that have missed loads of chances against Liverpool because they do give up chances regularly.
I'm sort of hoping it's like...
The hope that kills you.
No, but was it 2018 when Alisson scored a header against West Brom? And that got Liverpool into the top four, and then they went on and dominated beautifully. Maybe that's what Jota's goal represents, that amazing, you can't bottle it, really. It's a magical moment.
Whose place are they taking?
It'll
I don't think Man United are playing that well, to be honest.
No, they'll get over the line though.
Yeah,
game in hand as well.
Yes, it's not in Liverpool's hands, but I like to think a moment like that has to mean something because they generally do for Liverpool when they grab
Spurs
something
are an
at the
absolute
end.
Joke. I don't know how you can drive to once you've come back to do that. Like, well, it's probably because you've thrown on Lucas Moura to play as a wing back.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is understandable when you're trying to chase the game. But
I don't
then...
think Romero helped him out at all because I'm not really sure what he was expecting Moura to do.
You just clear don't it. Play that ball there.
No, I know, but it looked like initially, instead of the first time volley pass, you know, I know it was a cushion back, but that Moura was going to control it anyway. It didn't look like he was about to volley it down the other end of the pitch, so I thought Romero would have at least tried to drop off to give him a little angle to roll it back.
If he's going to control it, he needs to open his body out and do it down the line. You never control the ball inside.
But there was a player there.
You can open...
And there was a player inside.
No, there was a player in front of him. It wasn't outside him. You could open his body out and control it wide and try and play it down the line or something.
So
you just don't do anything inside there. But I'm a fullback. He's a winger.
Yeah. That was ridiculous, to be honest.
It was.
It was a good finish from Jota. It was a very good finish
from
Jota.
And Jota's like, we have to acknowledge he's... his return. It's funny, you know, all the myriad problems that Liverpool have had over the last, you know, 9 months or whatever, all the players you think, oh, Craig, we've, you know, been missing him or he's been subpar, all this. Jota's hardly been mentioned, like, really. And his impact has been, like, you know, remarkable since he's returned.
I don't think any of us would think... Liverpool can't get goals. They clearly can. It's a bit like saying Tottenham couldn't get goals. They mirror each other in many ways, Liverpool and Spurs, as in their forwards will get them goals. You know, we know that Son and Kane can. And we know that Salah, Jota, as you mentioned, Diaz, and others can get goals.
Everyone spoke about them. Darwin coming in, how was his impact? Gakpo coming in. Luis Diaz been missing. Salah's kind of, you know, if he was going off the boil for a little while. All these things were spoken about. Jota. Like even before his injury, he's been an absolutely outstanding buy for Liverpool. So his return has been huge for them.
So we're not expecting big things. It's clear from either of these sides for the rest of the season. But there were some juicy things to talk about from the game. Maybe we can box this one off quickly. Did Oliver Skipp deserve a red card? seemed to get a little bit of a toe poke, but his foot did come down very heavily on the top of the foot slash ankle. Would he have been sent off if you were the ref, Tony?
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad it's been addressed as well, because all the talk afterwards and the Basil Fawlty moment of, even if our younger listeners are not knowing who Basil Fawlty is, of smacking,
lots of
it was funny.
YouTube,
I thought, yeah, and I thought it got left out by lots of people after the game and didn't comment on, you know, you got Ryan Mason saying that, you know, he shouldn't have even been on the pitch. Well, the player, obviously the challenge on Skip late on by Jota, I thought Skip's challenge was a red card, and I'm really conservative on red cards. I think a lot of them are, you know, it's given out too easily, and yet that one, I thought that's a poor challenge.
It was dangerous, and
very dangerous
it was red.
Okay, anyway,
not for me.
Anyone unbiased in the room?
Not for me,
Gregor.
Not for me.
What do you mean, not for you?
It's not. It was a forceful tackle, and the ball bobbled up. He caught it, and then his follow through was a yellow card and a foul.
It's a bad height, Gregor. I'd love to. I'm always on your side, like as in my thinking around penalties. Oh, sorry, penalties of red cards, and I thought
it was
sorry.
Look, it was on the line, because it's one of those ones where, you know, he's trying to put a bit more on it than he has to. You know, he's going in forcefully with inside his foot. But because he clips the ball and because it's not that high, I think it's a yellow.
Did the same at Newcastle. Similar challenge at Newcastle.
He likes it, yeah.
He does exactly the same at Newcastle.
If he didn't get a toe poke onto the ball, I think it would have been a red card.
I agree, but he did.
So he saves himself. I would have given him a yellow for that as well. But I think it was one of those, maybe an orange card, because immediately, as soon as I saw it, messaged all my mates, that's a red, surely. And then, you know, I've had some time to think about it, and after seeing the assassination attempt on him a little bit later on in the game, I decided that I would downgrade it to a yellow, because Diogo Jota's challenge on Oliver Skip is the most blatant red card of the entire season. The fact that that was not given is a disgrace. The VAR... The official at Stockley Park has questions to answer, let alone Paul Tierney. How can you watch that video and not at least suggest to the referee that they should take a second look over at the screen? How? What are these officials being instructed to do? I mean, this is the, you know, you can box this one off as about the 8 millionth rant on VAR that we've had on this podcast, but I'm sorry.
Because that is because that's definitely the sort of challenge that you can only judge when you're there in the heat of the moment, and you can see the pace of the players and the intent of the players.
No.
It was not this, it wasn't thuggery. He was trying to reach the ball.
Skip
lowered his head at exactly the wrong second. It wasn't.
Lowered it to what height? Five foot three.
But it, stopped,
I mean, it was
it
high.
Stopped. Well, Jota's only tiny. It stopped. I didn't see that as a red, because I didn't think it was very forceful.
The podcast is over, guys. That's all we've got time for today.
Well, Peter Walton in today's time says it wasn't a red.
Well, listen, Peter Walton, I'm sure he's a lovely guy, and that's why we've hired him for the time, so I won't say anything negative about his refereeing opinions, but
it's wrong.
But I disagree. Let's put it that way. I disagree.
Do you know what occurred to me when he made the challenge, Jota? I kept thinking, wonder if he's done jiu-jitsu, or has he done Muay Thai? He's got his foot really high. Have you ever met anybody who can do jiu-jitsu or Muay Thai?
Yeah, yeah,
they
my
can
uncle.
Put their foot at the
taekwondo,
top of doors.
Black belt.
Yeah, and
shout out Uncle Barry.
I just thought, what?
Yeah, but it looked like one of those as well, because he didn't. We were speaking about this before. Normally, if you're going to flick the ball away or something, you lead with your toe. Mm. But it was a full heel, like a heel to the forehead. Yeah. Like, it was a red card. Mm. Because the things that matter are like where it is on the pitch, whether you can see him coming, and both those two things reflect badly on Jota's decision to stick his heel into Skip's head.
It was only little, he wouldn't expect it to reach anyone's face.
Such a clear and blatant red card as I've ever seen.
I don't disagree with Alison very often, but 1980s football, Alison, is... I think you're wrong on this one now.
In the 1980s, Jota wouldn't get a game. He'd be considered too slight and short.
It was a bad one, to be perfectly honest. It's one of those. The only thing that I'd say is, you know, he can't get a red card because he's had a yellow, for example. I just think that's a ridiculous law that we've got in our game about retrospective banning and stuff. Had the referee given nothing to Jota, he could have been subsequently given a ban and a red card retrospectively, he can't because the officials saw it and it was a yellow. I do think that's silly because ultimately endangering an opponent in a pretty severe way should still be punished. I still think that should be the case. But there you go. He probably will be back out there in Liverpool's next game unless something really drastic happens. It has kind of led to a bit of a debate after the game. Aside from the fact that when Diogo Jota scored the winner, Jurgen Klopp was in the face of the fourth official, did his hammy, so he might not appear in Liverpool's next game. But I think after the game, the comments were just a little bit... For me, it just leaves a bad taste in the mouth because I think Klopp has shown himself to be a great guy on so many occasions that when you see him doing this stuff, it just lets him down because I think people will gravitate towards the negativity when it comes to anyone. That's just what football's like. But, you know, these moments just let him down as a character because you see the great stuff about him getting the crowd going at all the right times during the game and some of the things that he brings to football. And then afterwards... You know, I hate the idea that a manager of a Premier League football club as great as Liverpool is going to come out and say, oh, not this ref again, he's got something against us, you know, basically leading the fans down a garden path towards this individual referee is biased against our football club is not a healthy place for football to go, in my opinion. But there you go, the Liverpool manager claiming that Paul Tierney spoke to him in an inappropriate manner on the touchline when he gave him the yellow for that celebration after Jota's winner. The PGMOL have disputed that version of events. They say in a statement today that match officials in the Premier League are recorded in all games via a communication system, and having fully reviewed the audio of referee Paul Tierney from today's fixture, we can confirm he acted in a professional manner throughout, including when issuing the caution to the Liverpool manager. So, therefore, we strongly refute any suggestion that Tierney's actions were improper. But it's just sad, isn't it? It's just sad.
Well, it's not going to... This might go quite badly for Klopp now, because it'll be there. The audio will be there. And he's going to have to explain, what exactly did you think you heard? Or have you made this up? Like, what... You know, he's in a sticky position now. He clearly wouldn't have realised that the referee's been...
But you know what? It depends. It depends, doesn't it? It depends on your levels. I mean, for all we know, he told Jurgen Klopp to shut up, which the PGMOL might think is absolutely acceptable and professional, and Jurgen Klopp thinks is...
I mean, I
totally
don't think
they
would have come out with a statement.
No, I know that. But what I'm saying is, we don't know what claim he's made. Do you see what I mean? And ultimately, he's the Liverpool manager. Maybe he expects a very high level of professionalism that maybe the PGMOL don't agree with. Like, it's, you know, if he is claiming that it was expletives, again, we've heard from players and ex-managers that there are officials that do use expletives when they talk to players and managers, and some of them don't mind it, some of them do. So it has to be, you know, we're really going to have to find out what the exact words are for this to be clarified, because we don't know what Paul Tierney said.
Klopp was in a strange mood, though. He was having a weird day. He really, really took offence.
It seemed like a normal day at the office, to be honest.
No, it was. He took offence at Ryan Mason, as though he didn't want someone who's a caretaker to have that much sort of anger in them and aggression towards him. He didn't like it. I mean, Ryan Mason, from looking at it objectively, of course is going to be really upset that Jota's on the pitch to score the winning goal after you think you've grabbed a late equaliser. And any manager probably feel that way, but for some reason Klopp seemed to think, how dare he, little Ryan Mason, have a go at one of my players. He didn't. He was just in a very strange, his whole demeanour on the touchline. I know he's a very expressive manager, Klopp, but there was something slightly different about him. I don't know if he'd tried to get the players up for it, and it's, you know, he's trying different things this season, because occasionally this season Klopp has said, I don't know what to do. This is all gone pear-shaped. I've got to do my best. I think he'd done something that made everyone slightly over-hyper, including himself. It wasn't him. He wasn't himself.
Have you worked, Hugh, with Ryan Mason?
Because I haven't.
I wondered if you had. Anybody here worked with Ryan Mason? I mean, because he's done radio and he's been...
Yeah, I've possibly done a show with him
once.
He's
a quiet guy.
Yeah.
And he's been put in a position where he thinks he's got to stand up against him and, you know, show that he's got... Because he acted like... completely out of context, Ryan Mason, where he's running and firing his fist. And I'm thinking, this is a guy that's quite quiet, you know, like, but he feels like he needs... And Arteta did a similar thing, didn't he, with Arsenal? Because they clashed, Klopp and Arteta, and maybe Klopp's thinking, well, hold it, you've got to earn your stripes, you know, and you're doing this,
I think we're getting off-piste here. Like, I mean, none of this justifies Jurgen Klopp
No,
seeing what he did. Well, you know,
no, we're trying to explain why
it doesn't
he
explain.
Was
any manager can be slightly combative on the touchline, but he runs. He's a serial offender. He ran over to the fourth official when he scored and got right in his face. And now he's saying he's accusing Paul Tierney of having an agenda again. Like it doesn't matter what Ryan Mason did. This is about Jurgen Klopp, and it's like his behaviour is not really, I don't think, acceptable on the touchline.
No, and he'll get punished. Look, Mourinho did it. Fergie did it. I'd even say Wenger did it at times. And there's many others, Conte, and Klopp is of a similar vein.
I can't remember, I understand what you mean about the antics on the touchline, but I can't remember those managers saying that an individual, and I will be corrected, I'm sure, on this, so it's at Hugh Wasencroft on Twitter, but...
Are you sure? Press conferences.
No, listen, I'm talking about, this is what I mean, if you can correct me, please do, about saying a specific individual has an agenda against their football team.
Again, I would be surprised.
All the rest, you know, there's a very famous chant, you know, about what Sir Alex Ferguson thinks about the referees. So
Mourinho would name check referees.
About having an agenda against the football team. I'm not saying that they haven't name checked referees for having bad performances, being terrible generally, but saying that they have something against me and my football team. That's the point that I'm making. I can't remember those managers basically, you know, talking about the reputation, you know, the integrity of an official in that way. But I am happy to be corrected on that.
I'd be a liar if I come on here and then said, as a player, I haven't managed, okay, as a player, and I haven't gone, oh, you know who the ref is today. Riggs, you been there?
Yeah.
Well, you've got a ref that you've had and he's given some bad decisions against you.
I get that you think they're terrible. I get that. Everyone has been in that position where they go, this official again. Yeah. But thinking that an official is terrible and thinking that they woke up this morning, you know, rubbing their hands together thinking, yes, I've got Liverpool today. I'm going to give every decision against them because I hate Jurgen Klopp. He's an idiot, or I hate this player or that player. I don't think these... even if you think that, I can't remember one of those managers coming out and saying that official has something against this football team. That's what I mean. Rather than saying that... Listen, say they're a bad official.
He's wrong. I'm not saying... I'm just putting in context of what the job of a manager becomes is quite funny because they all get caught up in it. I mean, apart from... Roy Hodgson, yes, who very rarely says a thing about any, you know, he's been an absolute gentleman in the game for not getting involved with criticism and referees and linesmen or whatever. But he's really rare, by the way. Most do. And Klopp will get punished, rightly so.
Yeah. And yet Roy Hodgson has one of the most famous clips of a post-match. of a post-match interview, but you're right. I think it's more about the media than it is about the officials. Okay, I just think some of this stuff, like I say, is beneath Jurgen Klopp. He's been a brilliant manager. He's still got a brilliant group of players. He doesn't need to be doing this.
Would you like it to be in the game or not be in the game?
Me,
but these characters that come.
I'd prefer these comments were out of the game for sure, because we don't have a game without the officials. Well, we absolutely. I'm not even saying take them for granted. We just kind of think that we can say whatever we want about them.
Plus, we keep having this conversation, and there's the broader, you know, context of like attitudes and behaviour towards officials. And Klopp is, as I said, a serial offender. He was like ran up to his face. Like I've been in passionate situations when you score a last minute winner like that, but I don't understand what is in his mindset, why he's done that, he's chosen to do that instead of celebrate the goal. What's going through his mind there?
I don't know. I think predicting what you do when it's spontaneous, I think if you really could guarantee premeditated, I think
but I think it just shows us in Jurgen Klopp's mind he truly feels like the officials had an agenda against him, and that's why he celebrates to the officials rather than Spurs, you know, bench or Spurs players or with his own fans, because he probably felt he was more against the officials on that day than he was against Tottenham Hotspur. That's, you know, I'm not saying he planned it, but that's how it came out in the moment. So I can understand if he truly feels that, then that's why he did it. But again, I'd rather these things not be in the game than in them, because I think we can be better than that. I'm just saying.
Lots said for an irrelevant game.
Yeah, no. Yeah. That's what I mean. It was totally irrelevant, but very, very fun. Kind of underlined some of the best bits of the Premier League so far this season. But yes, an utterly meaningless game between Tottenham Hotspur and Liverpool at Anfield. Anyway, let's move on to some matches that actually meant something in terms of how the league might end up. Bournemouth moving, I say, closer to securing their Premier League status. I think they are there. They beat Leeds 4-1 at the Vitality Stadium. Defeat for Leeds leaves them 16th, just a point above the relegation zone, regardless of the result between Leicester and Everton tonight. Only goal difference will keep them out of the bottom three a little bit later on. Meanwhile, Gary O'Neill's Bournemouth up to 13th, 10 points clear of the drop zone. So really, incredible job by Gary O'Neill, and you've got, for me, like I say, that's it for Bournemouth. They're going to be safe.
Yeah, I mean, Gary O'Neill said as much after. He said I thought 36 would be okay, and I think 39 were there now.
The level with Chelsea, for goodness sake, they have to say they're safe, don't they?
36 would have been okay. We were talking about this before, like, it's, I'm not sure that the teams that are going to go down will be able to find more than one more win. So it's an incredible achievement, because it's been so many ups and downs this season, and picking the team off the canvas during those downs has been arguably his most impressive feat. So, like, and he did a great interview in the Sunday Times actually with Johnny at the weekend, talking about his kind of, I think it was at Portsmouth when he was a young kid coming through, and Michael Edwards was like the you know, one of the first, I think he was a Prozone, wasn't he, when he first worked at Portsmouth in a porter cabin, and he used to go in and get all these, he's running stats and things like that, and he's always been really interested in all those kind of details. And I think he's taken that, and he says he's got a kind of phrase where he says, you know, grab each centimetre. I know it's like stealing a bit of Al Pacino's line from Any Given Sunday there, but he's clearly a details man, and he cares about all those, you know, every little last detail that adds up. And I think it's been an incredible turnaround, an incredible achievement. Everyone wrote them off, and as I say, from so many runs of, like, you know, losing six on the trot or whatever to bounce back, and now they've won, what, they're six of the last eight? Incredible.
Yeah.
I went to interview Philip Billing, and said, we don't know much about Gary O'Neill. What's he like, really? And he said, well, he does all the hard work, he does all the detail, does all the planning, but he tells us just to enjoy ourselves. I think if you can pull that off, A, for a team that everyone thinks is going to go down, it's under huge pressure because they've been in the relegation zone or close to it for all the whole season. They're a team that lost 9-0 at the start of the season, and you've come in and you are virtually a nobody. It's your first managerial job. If you can do all that work quietly away from the players and let the players just enjoy themselves once you've done all the gritty, nitty-gritty stuff, that means you've got a great future ahead of you as a manager, I think.
I'd argue as well to convince a new owner, a new American owner in Bill Foley, who came in midway through the season, to stick with them too during all those tough points. Like, they've obviously seen enough and probably taken soundings from some of the people at the club as well, but they've obviously seen enough to think that he was going to have enough to keep them up, and they've been proven right.
He's a great communicator. They're brave. He's really good communicator.
Yeah. Well, the football they've played is, I like them to Brighton and Brentford, who have been extraordinary in their, you know, their ideas of how they play and how they benefit from taking on teams. I interviewed Gary about 3.5-4 months ago, and it was quite funny because he said I was a mascot when you were in Sheridan, weren't you? He said I was a mascot for the day, and I went, oh right. He went, yeah. He said, because obviously that was his club, Millwall, and but he was so humble in his way, and not because he just said that, but after a conversation with him, and you know, you have to remind yourself of what Bournemouth were at the start of the season. You know, Scotty Parker, who went in and had his rant of, well, this lot, they're no good enough when he transfers. And yes, they have done business, but they've still got a large majority of them players that Scotty Parker didn't think were good enough to keep them up. And I when I thought they had a chance, and I like everybody else, thought they'd go down. I couldn't see them surviving at the start of the season. And the one time I thought, when they lost at the Emirates 3-2, I thought, they can stay up. They're afraid of nobody. They're going to try and win games. And that's exactly what they've kept to, you know, the word was, we're going to, and Gary did say that in the interview. He did say to me, we're going to try and win games. We're not going to draw them. We're not going to park bus. We haven't got the players to do that.
I did a show with Gary O'Neill, and he's such a smart guy.
I was just going to say,
he's such a smart guy. I think people sometimes look at his career as well, which I think was a very good career, and he was a very good player. And he actually got better and better as his career got on, and obviously I think typified by a kind of bit of quality on the ball, but very, very fit player as well throughout his career. But actually, just the way that he's gone into coaching with such commitment, you know, add that to, like I say, the intelligence that he has in terms of his football, I think he could be a really, really good coach for the future.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he came across as really intelligent in the interview as well. He was talking about how he tries to get over to the players that those, as he said, in those centimetres, those very fine margins are the difference between having a middling Premier League career and being a Champions League player. Like, he was saying that he actually reflects on his own career and kind of thinks, I could have done more. Or that he recognised, because he was one of those middling Premier League players, that it wouldn't have taken much for him to make that next step.
Yeah.
So he's constantly saying he's trying to get that over to the players and do whatever he can to help them improve. And that's got to be quite kind of empowering for them.
Remember our conversation at the very start about coaches and managers and the game Liverpool versus Spurs, without going back there, you know, and how much of an impact a manager or a coach can do? That's totally the case with Gary O'Neill. It is that. He's done brilliant.
Leeds United, you know, on the other side of things, have brought in Javi Gracia when they needed. Obviously, they had Jesse Marsh at the start of the season. They are far too easy to play against. I've probably watched their last three or four games and just thought, even when they're in matches, when the opposition get the ball, their ability to get into the final third, 9 times out of 10, into the penalty area, without much of a challenge, or without, not even that, because I think the Leeds players still put in a bit of a workload, but, you know, without any structure back there where you think, who's stopping them here? Or, you know, them being filtered into a particular area. They just kind of go where they want when they get into Leeds' half. It's, you know, I wouldn't even say Championship to see, although it might end up there. I look at them in terms of the bottom five clubs in the Premier League and think, despite the fact that they're a couple of places above the relegation zone right now, when I'm looking at how many points are going to be picked up between here and the end of the season, they're the club that I say zero.
Am I imagining it? Or I've got a fake memory? But I think every game I've seen Leeds play, they've started brilliantly and ended abysmally. There's something, they're almost the inverse of Spurs. They know how to get at you straight away. They're full of energy and they look like they might overwhelm anybody. And then somewhere around the 20-minute mark, 25-minute mark, it's like there's a puff of smoke and they then lose their shape and their energy. So again, someone in the back room needs to pace them better, I think.
I think it's often errors, though. It kind of sucks the life out of them. I mean, Melly is having a really tough time in goal. Mm. But then beyond that, they just... Crikey, sound like a broken record, but their defenders just aren't good enough for the Premier League. Robin Koch, what are you doing with that kind of little outstretched foot? I mean, what was that? Liam Cooper just keeps flying into challenges that are like just so reckless, and there's no composure whatsoever. It comes back to Victor Orta and Radrizzani again. We've spoken about, you know, they seem to be so keen to take all the plaudits when, you know, they're rushing onto the pitch last year at Brentford. I'm sure they'll do the same if they stay up this year. And like, I remember reading one of the pieces recently about he was kind of almost had to be pulled away from fans in the car park at Brentford last year, saying that you'd been out of the Premier League for 16, he said 17, he got it wrong, for 16 years before I came, as if like his work has got, you know, it was him who hauled Leeds back over.
Yeah.
I think the sooner they are rid of them, the better, and the takeover's completed. So there's a lot on the line for Leeds now, because it could happen this summer. The takeover by the 49ers could happen this summer if they stay up. If they don't, Radrizzani might stick around to make sure that he's selling an asset that's a Premier League asset, and they might not want to
invest
complete
in
it as well. So there's a lot on the line, and they look like the team most likely now.
Conceded 67 goals in the Premier League, the worst of all the teams. The Fulham game away just recently, where they lost 2-1, Gracia dropped the two fullbacks in Luke Ayling and Firpo. And it's clearly the case of he doesn't know how to get a back four, back five, whatever way they're going to play together. Because they look, like Gregor said and now was talked about, they just look like they're going to... And I'm glad you mentioned the keeper, because the keeper reasonably. He's done reasonably well over the years for Leeds United. He's had an absolute.
His confidence is shot.
It's clearly a case you need to drop your goalkeeper.
Yeah.
You need, as much as he might be, you're really proud of what he's done because he's still relatively very young. You've got to change your keeper.
He looks 14 still, weirdly,
yeah,
doesn't
he? Yeah, he does. But it also feels like it's affecting everybody in the back line. They feel nervous. They're not sure. There's no trust between the goalkeeper and the back defence. And I think he's got to make some big calls. If Leeds are going to stay up, the manager has to make calls that are going to be proved right because their running is not good. You know, they've got some tough games coming up.
Wilfred Nonto was the only positive I took from this because he was back on the pitch. The Leeds fans have been calling for him for some time. Set up a goal for Patrick Bamford, but it was very lively throughout. Had one cleared off the line as well. I do think that he's the kind of player that if you get something out of him for a game, yeah, it could be the vital 3 points that Leeds need to stay up.
But can he play centre-half?
Just as well as their current centre-halves, yes. I think he can, actually. It's just one of those with Leeds United. I think they lack composure in both penalty areas at the moment. And I've said about them throughout the season, they're a team that if they don't take their chances, they'll lose the game, but they usually create enough chances to win a game. They just haven't been good enough in front of goal so far this season. And the defensive thing has been actually an issue for them since they were promoted.
That's the championship.
They just haven't... Yeah,
they're a good defender.
They just haven't addressed it since they've been promoted.
And they keep signing... Wilbur, they signed in January as well, I think, and he's... He's on the bench. He came on. It's a damning indictment on Orta. There's been a few players who you think like Brendan Aaronson's come in. McKennie's not really. You know, you would have said he's a good signing. You would have said that we thought that's a good signing, but it's not really happened for him yet. He needs some time perhaps to settle. But there's not been many hits, and I think that's a damning indictment of them.
Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
It would have been worse for Leeds United had Nottingham Forest taken all 3 points this weekend. Heartbreak for them. Late fight back from Brentford took all 3 points, and it didn't really help Forest in terms of their Premier League survival hopes. They were kind of hanging on. They only had 10 men on the pitch after Danilo went off injured, and then the substitute Jos De Silva scoring a 94th minute winner, which was only confirmed after a long VAR check. We went over it just before the podcast, watched it back, and it looks like it was just onside.
We're only questioning it because afterwards, Steve Cooper, I don't think he's normally like this, but he was sort of implying there was some sort of conspiracy theory going on. He was going, I haven't seen the image. I hope they're not making a judgment call. I hope there is a definitive image. Well, there was a definitive image in the press box. There was always clearly one going around. He just hasn't seen it yet. The goal was fine. There was nothing iffy about it. It was a classic case of him trying to be incredibly defensive. And Thomas Frank praised him for it. They did a good job. They were quite, I would say, Steve Cooper did the right thing, even though he lost, because if there's one problem Brentford have is that they're much, much better when they're considered the underdog. So I was at the game where they won at Stamford Bridge, and you could argue they weren't the underdog on the day, really, but they pretended they were, and so were able to cope with Chelsea livening up in the second half, and they enjoyed having to defend and they enjoyed playing on the break. They don't really want possession. But Forest just gave them all the possession they wanted. I think it might have been a record for Brentford in the Premier League. They had 69% possession and they didn't really know what to do with it. I mean, they looked quite pretty with it, but they didn't really know what to do with it. But Thomas Frank, because he is probably the manager of the season, he knew in advance this was a possibility that Forest, given the plight they're in, would just go for the all-out defence. We don't care if we have none of the ball at all. And so he didn't react to it. He planned it in advance. If we can't score against them with lots of possession, I've got all my subs set up, brought them all on, made a huge change. One of those subs scored the winning goal. So it wasn't like he got lucky, Thomas Frank. He just knew that was a possibility, that Forest would try it. Nearly paid off for them, and it didn't. But they're not... I would agree with you, Hugh. If you're looking at the teams that might go down, Forest do look in better shape than Leeds right now. Much better shape, I would say.
Southampton next as well.
Southampton next, massive, particularly at the City Ground. They have to win that. If Forest do end up going down, you kind of look at the second half of the season and think it would have been the games against the teams around them that cost them, because they lost 4-0 at West Ham, drew to all at home against Everton, drew with Wolves as well, and then went to Leeds and lost. So, and that was a kind of short period around early March, late February. They've still got it, you know, if you like, in their hands. They go to Palace on the final day. I think that's a possibility for them, particularly as Palace look like they're absolutely safe. Obviously, the game against Southampton's huge. Go away to Chelsea. I do still think that's a possibility for every team who goes to Stamford Bridge right now. They've got absolutely no confidence. And again, the City Ground, I think if you've been there for a match and you understand the atmosphere that is created and the way that, you know, lends itself to the performance of the team, there's a chance for them to get something out of the game against Arsenal, which is the penultimate game of the season, the last game of the season though at the City Ground. So I think being the final home game of the season, having that carrot of playing against, you know, one of the best teams in the league, anything can happen. Anything pretty much has happened in terms of the Premier League season so far. So I wouldn't write off Forest from picking up points in that game. But as I go back to earlier, I don't see where Leeds United are going to pick their points up. But I also think Forest aren't playing that badly over the last three or four games. Obviously, they beat Brighton, but the performance against Liverpool, they could have got something out of as well. Even this weekend against Brentford, not an easy place to go. They could have got something out of the game. So if they keep performing at the same level, they will win, I think, another match in this season.
It's just that they're managing to find new ways of conceding bad goals. And just watching this again and for the last few weeks, thinking this could have been much, you know, so different if Dean Henderson hadn't got injured. Keylor Navas came in, and remember he had a really eye-catching debut, yeah, I think it was, and it was like pulling off saves. You think, oh, what a sign. It's not been the one. I think that free kick trickling in at the near post, no way that goes.
I spoke to Mark Crosley, the former Forest goalkeeper, on Saturday, and I'd said about Neves, and he said he's done really well, and then he had his worst game of the season, or his worst performance for Forest, in this particular game, and like Gregor. And it's really weird because what Alisson touched on is like them fine lines of, you know, they've played really well and could have, and were set up really nicely. The goalkeeper don't make mistakes. They walk away with maybe one point or even three. That fine line with Forest, and they've been a bit like that all season, where they look like they can get something out of a game, and for whatever reason, someone stepped up to the plate and made a mistake.
Well, we've mentioned them a couple of times so far in the podcast, Southampton, who I think are now gone. I think this was the weekend. And they weren't expecting much out of the game, obviously. They went to St James's Park. They actually went ahead, but Newcastle fought back to win the game 3-1, strengthened their place in terms of the top four. Southampton now 6 points adrift at the bottom of the table, staring relegation to the Championship in the face. They've got four games left, and I just can't see it happening. But we'll start by, I think, giving some positivity to Newcastle. Callum Wilson came on at half-time, moved on to 15 league goals, getting a couple in the game. It's now 24 points from the last 27 available for Eddie Howe's side. And, you know, they're not just going to be making up the numbers in the Champions League, I think, particularly if they can strengthen in the summer and add some more quality players. There's a real harmony there. I've said it before on the podcast. I just think you can't change too much. That's how well it's going for them at the moment. I mean, yeah, I know it's Southampton, but I think you watch the scenes, the ball hitting the back of the net, every time it does at St James's Park, they just seem to get stronger and stronger at the moment. Tony, what do you think about it?
What, on Southampton or Newcastle?
Newcastle United.
Well, you sort of said it there. We've seen what Newcastle are about all season. We see that they give very little away. And we've talked about organisation this morning on the podcast. And Newcastle are really well organised. They're one of them sides that give you very little. And they've also got players who want to prove a point about being good enough. Willock, Joe Linton, you know, Murphy as well, Jacob Murphy. You know, they've got these type of players. And that little bit of stardust that they've got with Isak, who adds more. Callum Wilson, I spoke to you about Callum Wilson Hugh when we were in Qatar. Mm. I've always really liked him because I think if you look at him over a course of a season, you'll probably get 10 goals, you know, at a club even that will finish in the bottom end of the table. And they're quite rare as strikers to get. And he may be not the best out there, but I do feel that he'll always chip in with a number of goals. He'll lead the line well. He'll use his presence physically and he does it really well. So I'm really pleased. I'm watching a Newcastle. I mean, Newcastle's such a weird story of where they were not so long ago and where they are now.
This is a team that's like most reminds us of Leicester in terms of how they're getting so much more than the sum of their parts.
Absolutely.
Now it seems to have changed for me a little bit. I look at their team now and it's like their stature has been elevated. I look at Joe Ellington and Gumarez and Willock and I think what a midfield three that is. Isaac's got like some of the things he's been doing, that little mazy run against Everton, incredible, and the way that they're able to switch him and Wilson, and like players like Murphy we spoke the other week, but he's keeping Almiron out of the team now, so there's like competition everywhere, and I just feel like what they've done this season, it's I think the same sort of thing happened with Leicester, because you get used to such a level of performance, you just look at the team differently. You look at what they're capable of and they look like, as you say, a completely such a together team as well.
They've got
we have to keep speaking about what Newcastle is, but we also have to admire the job that Eddie Howe has done. I can't do anything otherwise, because I think it's been an incredible job.
Just on Southampton, 6 points from safety, 4 games to go. All over.
Well, you know, does it matter? Because Ruben Selles always looks very smart from day one.
Oh, Jesus.
When he made it very clear, he didn't want to be caretaker. No, he wanted to be a top level. Think of me. I'm very important and I can look the part. So the first time he took the team, he was like, oh, goodness knows how much he spent on his outfit.
But it lovely roll neck.
It was just so immaculate, that sort of look. He wanted to look like he'd been doing the top job for a decade. And he continues to look absolutely smart. But I think he spends too much time in front of the mirror, because there's a team there at Southampton. And I am convinced that if Hasenhüttl hadn't been sacked, he'd have got them over the line. So they've made a big mistake at that club.
Still think it would have been tough for Nathan Jones. Obviously, it was going very, very badly for him. All Ralph Hasenhüttl to keep this Southampton team
up. Well, his stats
up.
Are better.
No, simply because of the squad. I think inexperience has played a massive part in their season. Lack of cohesion. But really, you know, they've taken a huge risk with their recruitment. And they had big injuries to some of the better players that they bought within that early on in the season. And they just didn't have the experience or the quality to stay up. I kind of find it a little bit strange that some of the players they bought in January haven't been given more of an opportunity. Orsic, Onuachu, for example, given... Sulemana as well, given how bad they've played. I think you brought these players in January surely to try and keep you in the Premier League, and some of them have barely featured, so I think that's the strangest thing, but they're gone now.
They're going to be stripped.
Yeah.
I think Lavia will go.
Looks good.
Ward-Prowse will go.
Alcaraz looks good.
Yeah.
Bela Kotchup, I think, looks good. Although he's played in a back, you know, a defence that's been.
But do you have it within you, because their contracts are pretty new, to maybe loan them out for a season?
I think they'll need to recoup some money.
Or do you need them to try and get you up? Ultimately, they're your players.
You're balancing act,
because the thing is, these players aren't going to be on huge contracts, because a lot of them are very young and a lot of them came from obscure places. So you do have the opportunity. I think if you're Southampton, you're serious about being in the Premier League, I'd want to keep them in the Championship. A lot of those players, the money would have to be totally.
Ward-Prowse will be the one.
Ward-Prowse will be gone, but he's got a huge contract, so you'd almost want him off the wage bill. But some of the others will not have huge contracts, so it may be worth keeping hold of them. They're young players, they're inexperienced. You're going to get a bit of a shock when you go to the Championship, but you will be playing, you know, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, and that's going to help. It's a different style of football, yes, but in terms of that experience, in terms of maybe a more gritty style of football in the Championship, certainly a tougher lifestyle, then it might be good for those players to go down
to the
Championship.
It's going to be a weird one for Southampton next year because... It feels like the club, I mean, I've seen a lot of empty seats at a number of games at Southampton this season, and just feel the young team that they went for and the signings, the type of signings they went for, they've paid a bit of a price, because I've always defended Alan Hansen's comments about you can't win nothing with kids, because generally you can't. You know, you just don't.
Yeah.
Experience counts for a lot, and, you know, players improve as they go along. I think they've suffered, and definitely Arsenal too was a, I think it was a mistake, because you made big decisions last year with the coaching staff and he stayed and some of the others departed. I think you made a big call and you had to stay with it, you know, and I don't see them bouncing back. And I know it's easy to go, oh, they'll go down to League One. I'm not going to say that. I just don't see them bouncing back very easily. I think it's going to be very tricky for them. Remember, Ward-Prowse has been their top goal scorer this season and last season. You know, he will go out the door. So they're going to have to find goals, because they can't seem to find anywhere else with goals.
And Ruben Selletz needs to work out, what do you wear in the Championship? I mean, what's
well, Ruben,
the look?
Ruben
what's
Selletz, the look? Ruben Selletz will not be in charge in the Championship. But I think what's interesting is, you know, I know it's a very small sample size, but what Vincent Kompany's done at Burnley suggests that you can turn things around very, very quickly.
And there's also actually, like, the bones of... something that could be quite exciting for Southampton.
Yeah.
Like there was excitement when Sport Republic came in. You know, Rasmus Ankersen of Brentford, you know, renowned, is kind of leading a lot of what they do in the football department. And we've spoken about it. There's been some big hits, although they're just kids. Like, they've signed some good players. They just went too far in one direction. And
there are kids in that Southampton squad who would have good seasons in the Championship. It's just whether they want to play in the second tier.
Sekou Mara's another one who's like...
Sekou Mara, I think, would be good. Samuel Adozie, I think he came from City. I think he would be a good player in the Championship. Lavia, if they can keep him, would obviously excel in the Championship. Central defender-wise, I think they've got enough to have a good defence in the Championship. But again, do you keep Carletta Sarr? Unlikely. Bednarek, unlikely. To be playing
Belakovic
as a German international, so it's very unlikely to keep those players. And even the goalkeeping situation, Bazunu was great in League One, clearly not yet ready for the Premier League. Could he be good enough for the Championship? And even Alex McCarthy came back in goal at the weekend. I think he's good enough to play in the Championship. So you never know. I think, look, Walker Peters, the like, there's going to be a bit of an exodus. They've got Nathan Teller. And that would be a big one. I saw him recently at the EFL Awards and I said, what's Southampton saying to you at the moment? He kind of grimaced a little bit because he's a Southampton player, but he's desperate to play in the Premier League. And he feels like he's found a bit of a home at Burnley and had the most success so far in his career. For me, Southampton have to keep him, unfortunately.
What did you wear at the EFL?
It was black tie. So, yeah, tux. But yeah, tough for Southampton fans to take this weekend and disappointment for them. Again, it's not over yet, but it would take a bit of a mini miracle, in my opinion, for them to stay up. Let's talk about one of the, a couple of, I think, really entertaining games to finish the podcast off. Maybe not with a great meaning either. Although Crystal Palace edging a 7-goal thriller against West Ham meant that they reached the 40-point mark. So they, I think, will be staying in the Premier League. Hodgson's led Palace to 4 wins in 6 games since he came back, 11 points clear of the bottom 3, West Ham 5 points above the drop, and with a game in hand over the 2 teams immediately beneath them, so they could be safe as well. So really, it's just, I think one of the things that I took out of this game, another game where Palace scored a few goals and looked pretty good going forward, was not, I always felt Roy Hodgson would get the results before the end of the season that meant they would have stayed up. To be honest, I thought Patrick Vieira would as well. But they've been exciting, Crystal Palace. They've been fun. So whatever Roy was doing in his first retirement, he's kind of come back and said, oh, it doesn't matter anymore, boys. We don't have to defend as much as we used to. Go and enjoy yourselves. Like I said, I spoke to Jordan Ayew and Jeffrey Schlupp on Friday before the game. And they told me, Roy had told them, it's just all about confidence within a lot of attacking stuff. We just kind of go out there, shoot, have a laugh, enjoy ourselves, and then we go out on Saturday and try and do the same thing. So there you go.
Well, if you'd taken a straw poll of just sort of not huge football fans, just people who like their football, said, what would you expect from a Roy Hodgson return to Crystal Palace? They'd have probably said, oh, they'll probably be really good at set pieces, defending set pieces, and probably quite quiet going forward, probably be quite dull. I don't know what he's eating for breakfast now, but they are so exciting going forward. He's just told them, you're very talented, have fun. They were dreadful defending set pieces against West Ham. I mean, I just thought, oh, my goodness. Yeah, exactly. So, like they look really flimsy and slightly scared of it. And so he's just, I don't know, classic case of he's got 60-odd years experience of football all over Europe, and he's just decided he knows it. He's found that sort of quiet confidence where he just knows. He knows a good player when he sees one. He knows what players need. And if, because I mean, it hasn't changed anything. He's just gone in there and realised that they weren't using their assets properly. They weren't exploiting what they had, and just told them to enjoy it. What he said, the crucial thing he said, Roy, was that he told the players it was down to him. If they attacked and it went wrong, it was his fault, not their fault. If they attack and try a shot and it doesn't come off, it's not their fault, it's his fault. And he's taken that burden of responsibility off them. So all that inherent talent is allowed to flow, and it's excellent fun.
Gary Jacobs' column in The Times suggested Palace need to be careful or they'll lose Michael Olise very soon. What do you make of his performance?
Yeah, he's been outstanding, particularly since Hodgson's come back. He's just a joy to watch, isn't he? We kind of, every time he cuts inside, you think he's either going to whip in an absolutely, you know, impeccable cross to the back post or find the far corner. He's just got an absolute wand of a left foot, and he can always chop down the line as well. He'd be a nightmare to mark. But, you know, Hodgson, as you said that we need, I think, you know, Gary, who always knows the ins and outs of London clubs, have you seen that a £35 million release clause had been removed from his contract this season, we presume with a new contract, but they got him for a bargain. It's like 8 million,
yeah,
and that would have been a bargain, so that is a big boost. And Hodgson said the only thing, you know, he needs to add more goals. I think he's got 2 Premier League goals this season, you know, loads of assists. He always had a hand in goals, even when he was coming off the bench earlier in the season. I think over a period where he had like the lowest, you know, the best ratio of goal creation per minutes kind of thing. So he's a big impact player as well. So I think the world is his oyster if he, you know, he's a bit of a aloof, quiet, you know, there's been some interviews where it's like he just gives one word answers and stuff. He seems to be, I don't know whether the only thing that's going to hold him back might be him. I don't know, that's just a guess.
For me, it's just a consistency. But I think once he gets really confident,
having
his
a mindset, a mindset of him being a big player, potentially one of the biggest players in the Premier League.
Yeah,
like if he's in that mindset, then he can be that. I believe he can.
Yeah, for sure.
It was pretty common knowledge in the game that the reason why Patrick Vieira lost his job was more to do with about certain players technically not being able to perform of what they felt upstairs of their capability. So Patrick Vieira's team couldn't buy a goal. And you know, Roy's team have come in, and you know, you couldn't think, you know, when you say, oh, how can a manager have any sort of relationship with young players when he's a certain age difference? You know, Roy's the oldest of all the football managers. He's got, you know, still a number of young players at Palace, and yet he probably goes, well, I don't really need to forge a relationship with them as long as they do what I want them to do on the football field and they express themselves. That's all I want from them. I don't need to know about what the young footballer needs to do. And I think Roy's smart enough to know that my job is to get them to show their potential and their ability on the football field. And it does feel like Palace are quite a free team.
I'm just going to say, like, as brilliant a job as Roy Hodgson has done, we're in danger of recency bias here. If Roy Hodgson was to be given the job, I would be very surprised if we continue to see this. Yeah. Roy Hodgson has been the type of manager Roy Hodgson has been for several decades. So, like, let's not get too carried away about this.
No.
He's done a great job. He's lifted them. He's unburdened them, as you say.
So, okay, I'll ask you a question, Gregor. If Roy Hodgson was 45 and it just happened what he did, what would you say would the answer be if they...
Well, he wouldn't have 3 decades of what we've seen evidence of how Roy Hodgson's team have played. So I would say give him the chance. But we've seen what Roy Hodgson is as a manager over several decades. And it's not this on a consistent basis.
Would you want him having an involvement in the football club of some capacity?
No.
Or would you literally want to put him to...
Yeah, send him on.
Wow.
I don't mean that to be... But Mark Samuel wrote this...
Terribly rude.
Martin Samuel wrote this in his column the other day. It's a very valid point. Like, no manager coming in wants Roy Hodgson upstairs when he knows he wants his job. So there's no... It's not like...
But then he doesn't... Martin obviously doesn't know Roy Hodgson. Roy is not a guy that's going to be knifing anybody in the back, quite clearly.
I'm not going to be knifing him in the back,
Martin, he wants the job.
He wants the job more than he wants the job upstairs.
Yeah.
So that's a pressure.
No. Roy would not, I can guarantee you now, Roy would not take a job upstairs at Palace knowing he was hoping that the manager might fail so he could step in again.
I'm not saying that either, but his presence there would be something would be a pressure on the manager.
It would be so avuncular.
I think, look, can I just add one point? This is a really valid one. I was at a dinner next to Roy, and I talked to Roy about football and about a job and if a job would come up.
Yeah.
And he was very open about where he is in his life, about still wanting to be involved in football and would want to help. His whole reason to go back to Palace was to help them get out of the mire. So if he thought he could help it upstairs as well, he is not going to be an interference, that Martin was alluding to in his column. Because I read that column as well, and I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to think that Roy Hodgson would be that way.
It would be intentional. It wouldn't be like, you know, it's just that his presence there would be... could potentially be undermining if things went, you know, had an iffy patch. Like, oh, well, we've got him upstairs who's come in on 2 occasions now and saved the club. Like,
I think he only wants to help. Honestly, Greg,
I completely agree with you.
He only wants to help.
It wouldn't help the club.
Yeah.
For that reason, it might not work at Palace, but he could still be a director of football somewhere else where he hasn't had the history of being a manager.
He could still be a manager somewhere else.
I don't think he wants to be a manager somewhere else.
He shouldn't be a manager because he's 75. I'm just saying that if Palace want to take a new direction, he's not the man to do it.
Okay, all right. I got to say, Palace did deserve to win this game, but the penalty decision at the end was incredibly poor. Incredibly poor. There was no contact with the feet. There was a little hand that brushed the hip, a la Strictly Come Dancing. And usually if you fall like that, you don't get 10 marks. But in football, it's totally different. You point straight to the spot. It's a penalty and a goal for Eze. But there's no point, I think, reacting to that, just to say, whilst we're on the referees on this podcast, that was a poor one. Right, very quickly, Brighton. Just a 6-0 win over Wolves, reigniting their hopes for Europe next season. It was their biggest ever top flight victory. 3 players got a brace in the game, but they were just a joy to watch. I know it was poor from Wolves as well.
Brighton, I don't know. What are they doing? They rested the 3 players anyone's heard of that you might think are really famous.
The famous Paul Merson clip from the weekend, he's added to his showreel by saying, what on earth is the manager doing dropping these 3 players? he obviously doesn't want them to get into Europe. And then they won 6-0. So,
but come on, it's true. But I can see, he went a bit far. But I mean, you would be generally disappointed because Mitoma's had the most amazing, he's been player of the season post-World Cup. So not of the season, but he's had a fantastic period at Brighton. And if you were turning up there, he'd be the player you really want to see. And he doesn't start. And you think, oh, OK. Oh, there's no McAllister either. And you just think, Caicedo is the player everyone's linking with, you know, who's going to bolster the midfields, all need bolstering. And all 3 arrested, and they managed to out-Brighton Brighton's normal, amazing football. So they are incredible. Absolutely incredible.
It's amazing. It's just an amazing story that, I mean, look, Bloom owns a club in Belgium, St. Gilloise, and I've come from there, scored lots of goals there. Comes in, didn't have a particularly good game in the semi-final of the cup, did he? Had a couple of half chances, gets a brace. Welbeck, who many clubs deemed were you know, finished his days at being the best and is still, you know, offers a lot to Brighton. I just think the story is, it's just so incredible. It feels like it's mystique in some ways of how the owner and the rest of the club, how it's run, and from the recruitment team must be obviously brilliant. And then the type of players they look at is just extraordinary. And I trust nearly every decision, even ones I don't even know anything about. I think, well, Brighton have got that right. Because everyone else, they keep doing this. This conveyor belt of right decisions is ridiculous.
And it's the bravery to go for a lot of these players at a particular age where nothing is destined. You know, it's signing 18, 19-year-olds, some of them even earlier than that. And
Ferguson.
Yeah, and managing to get them into the first team in such a short period of time and performing in the Premier League.
It's also seeing more from some players like Pascal Gross.
Yeah.
And he joined them in 2017.
But Gross has always been an incredibly intelligent player, and his ability to play, they played him in so many different roles.
Yeah, but he's played as an auxiliary right back, who's playing as an auxiliary number 10 this season.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I know he's been intelligent, but he's doing things that this season that I haven't seen really
before.
I've always thought
he was, well, do you know what, Dunk. I support Man United, so I've always thought he's a great player because he scored 6 or 7 career goals against us, so he's always popped up and had great performances against Manchester United.
And Lewis Dunk was like the epitome of Chris Hughton's head it and boot it centre half. Mm. And now he's playing the most like line split passes like out of any defender in the Premier League.
But Dunk should have been playing for England for the last 4 years.
Well, it's easy to say that now, but if he's playing in a team like this 3 or 4 years ago, maybe he would have. He was playing in Chris Hughton's team.
Eric Dyer was in the England team.
I mean, you could go through 90% of the Brighton team and you can just go, wow, every one of them is just from left back to right. I mean, Veltman at right back's been to me. I watched him. He's one pace. He's not the most gifted, but he does a great job when required and when called upon.
The most exciting bit, there's more to come from Billy Gilmour.
I knew you'd mention Billy Gilmour. Do you know the one mistake? I don't know if you discussed this when I wasn't here, but the one big mistake De Zerbi has made this season is not bringing Jason Steele off the bench for penalties in the semi-final. Because he is renowned at the club as being the better penalty saver, and he didn't bring him on. And I just thought, well, that immediately thought, well, you've not got to the final, mate, and they didn't.
Okay, all right.
He's not perfect.
No, I mean, that's a big question. I think Brighton are kind of gearing up for him not to be the manager next season, so it's kind of an interesting one to see if they can build on what he's currently doing.
They're always gearing up.
If he's not there. Yeah, but I think they kind of know that he's going to have job offers that are too good to turn down.
Maybe.
All right. Fantastic from Brighton. Got to be said. But finally, just because you're here, Tony, wanting to talk about a man who's very much cut from the same cloth as you, as Manchester City beat Fulham and Erling Haaland scores his 50th goal of the season in all competitions, a penalty very early on. He became the first top flight player to reach half a century of goals in one campaign since Tom Pongo Waring did for Aston Villa in 1931. So it's quite incredible what he's doing. He also moves level for most goals in a Premier League season with 34, same as Andy Cole for Newcastle, and the amount that Alan Shearer got for Blackburn a year later. But I don't really want to talk up Haaland too much. We've done that a lot. Julian Alvarez in this game, winning the penalty, scoring a brilliant winner as well. For me, every time I watch him, how can you stay at City? How can you stay at City? Because you're way too good to be a sub. And the rumours are that everyone kind of knows that Erling Haaland's not going to spend the rest of his career at Manchester City. And so they're desperate to keep Julian Alvarez to the point that they want to offer him a big new contract, lengthy contract now. And there were some rumours that he wanted to go to Spain and play for Barcelona because they were rumoured to be interested. Lots of rumours. Mm. But ultimately, if they keep him, he's one heck of a player.
I think you'd probably go for the whole team of Man City players, in or out the team, that clubs will want. Because anyone who comes into the team does brilliantly well, and he's certainly one of them. I think his desire, athleticism, and just enthusiasm for the game has stood out for me. It was like in the World Cup. You feel like Argentina came alight when he was on, and because he didn't start the tournament for Argentina, did he? You know, and then as the tournament wore on, he got caught up in the euphoria of Argentina, and he's brought that to City, and he's not been a player that feels like he's given a right to be in this team. Haaland's done so well. I just love the fact that he played Haaland and you saw him playing in a more slightly deeper position, but that ability just to run in between people. And his goal was, well, probably the goal of the weekend. It was a great strike.
How can you just talk like that when Tim Ream has a broken arm and just pretend it didn't happen?
I didn't realise.
Broken arm.
Definitely broken.
Yeah, no one talks about it. If it had been a City player who broke their arm, no.
Well, we wish Tim Ream all the best, Alison, but it was still a fantastic performance from Manchester City. Haaland and Alvarez, absolutely brilliant. I mean, I don't know how long they'll be able to keep hold of either of these players, to be perfectly honest, because if they win the Champions League in particular, I'd give Erling Haaland another couple of seasons before Real Madrid, you know, probably break another bank so that he can sign another world-class player that scores 50-odd goals a season. And then Alvarez, I'm not sure if he'll wait, to be perfectly honest, because for me, it's his intelligence and his awareness. I mean, the little drag back for the goal, even the you know, it's not just the touch off the knee/thigh to deceive Tim Ream, but it's just the kind of delay on that run to allow the ball to actually come into that space and across him. He's just so good, Alvarez. And I just a player that we don't see enough of, really. And I'm just hopeful that we will get the chance to do that. Hopefully not in the FA Cup final next month. But apart from that, I'm more than happy to see him playing. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for being with me for this length of time. Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino and Alison Rudd. And to all of you for listening, remember it's Monday, so check out the game. All the best of the weekend. Pick up a paper. You can go online as well, thetimes.co.uk/the game, or you can download the Times app wherever you get your apps from. Much more football on the way this week. Massive game for Leicester and Everton tonight. Who knows? Maybe Chelsea will kill Arsenal's fading hopes of winning the Premier League title on Tuesday night. More games Wednesday night as well. So plenty for us to discuss on Thursday. We will see you then.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.